Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and open up the Senate Committee on Judiciary. I want to thank everyone for being here this morning. We have three bills that are on our agenda today. The first is a carryover from yesterday, if I remember correctly, Senate Bill 1554. We now have all the paperwork, so we're going to go ahead and open up the work session on Senate Bill 1554. And does anyone need any reminder before we vote on this one?
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment into Senate Bill 1554.
Senator Cruz moves that we amend the bill with the Dash 1 amendments into Senate Bill 1554. Discussion?
I think it would be good to just remind people what it is.
Okay. So, sure. Chair?
Chair Przanski, Senator Thatcher, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1554 is your digital assets bill. Remember, this came from the Uniform Law Commission and is a consensus bill between the tech industry and probate attorneys at the national level and is being implemented in 26 different states this year. This allows a fiduciary, such as a personal representative, trustee, or conservator, access to digital content of a user while limiting undue access and protecting privacy interests. It allows for the custodian of the records to offer a catalog or to submit a catalog should one be requested, and provides opportunities for the fiduciary to obtain the contents of records per a user choice, will, or trust, other protective documents, or through a court order.
All right. So with that information, colleagues, are there any questions or comments? If not, we have a motion before us to adopt the Dash 1 amendments in the Senate Bill 1554. Is there any objection? So ordered. And Senator Gelser is excused for the votes until she's able to get here. She had another obligation prior to our starting our committee today. So with that, we'll go ahead and close the work session.
No.
The chair.
We just adopted.
Yeah, okay. We just adopted.
We just adopted the amendment. Okay, Ms. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1554 as amended by the Dash 1 amendment to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
I apologize. It's a little early, I guess. So we now have a motion to Senate Bill 1554 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as it was amended by the Dash 1 amendments. Any discussion? Any objections?
I would suggest that as you be the chief sponsor, you carry it.
I will do that.
Okay.
I'll take one for the team. And with that, we'll go ahead and close the work session on Senate Bill 1554. We're now into our public hearings. We're going to open up our first public hearing, which will be on Senate Bill 1552, is that the order we're going?
Sure.
And with that, I'm not sure who's taking the lead.
Well, Senator Przanski and members of the committee, I'll go ahead and give you some background on this bill. The Oregon Advanced Directive Form was developed in 1993 and was the first of its kind in the nation, but since its adoption, it has not been modified in any way. We had a bill in the last session, which we sent into a work group. This very large work group did a lot of really great work on this and has now come to a consensus. You have the bill in front of you as well as the proposed Dash 1 amendments. And if you would like, I can go through a section by section of the Dash 1 amendments. The Dash 1s largely incorporate the underlying bill and make a few changes to it. So I would ask you to look at the Dash 1s as your point of reference. Would you like a section by section on this one?
Colleagues, how detailed do you want on the preview to be? Because I'm assuming we're going to have a pretty good description for all the bills who are presenting.
Let's let the
presenters, the certified smarts.
Yeah.
Okay. Right.
Not that you're not certified. So, all right. If that's it, then we have four individuals that are on our list. It looks like everyone's coming in support. I don't know if there is a preference of who we bring up first. I'll just say that individuals we have listed as Jessica Adamson, and along with her is Kevin, I think it's Dixon, and then Tom Hoyt, and then Jack Dempsey. So if you want all four to come up, we can grab another chair, or if you want to do three and one, it looks like Jack's fine with that. So, Jessica, I think we're just going to do the three. Thank you, though. And we'll let you all direct us, lead us through. through this process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jessica Adamson here on behalf of Providence Health and Services, and we are here in support of this legislation. I want to start by thanking Chana for her tremendous work in leading what has been a very large work group. In short, this bill does make important changes. Specifically, it allows the process for advance directives to go from being pretty constrained by statute to enabling a work group through best practices with a focus on consumers and patients to create a form for instructions that will speak to enabling those folks to share their values and beliefs with respect to healthcare and be able to enable them to have their conversations with their provider, with their families, and really be able to determine what's the best course of action, whether it's at the end of their life or whether it's on an ongoing chronic care situation where they're no longer able to make decisions for themselves. As providers, we see people every day who are no longer in a capacity to make those decisions but have years left at the end of their lives. And so being able to know what their values and priorities are enables us to help guide and provide options for their healthcare representatives in terms of what that are consistent with the values that have been set out by the person who filled out the advance directives. We are concerned that 50% of Oregonians who attempt to fill out an advance directive today don't complete it because of the nature and constraints of the form. We think that every Oregonian, regardless of age, needs an advance directive. It's important because no one knows what the future may hold, and being able to speak for yourself at a time where you're able to make those decisions enables a much smoother transition for families and support and for the healthcare representatives when that time may come. So we, again, really support this legislation. My ethicist, Kevin Dirksen, with Providence, will kind of lay out some of our guiding principles and how this legislation meets against those. We do want to very briefly recognize that there are, because of the nature of the length of this amendment, there are a couple of issues that we'll be catching, and we are very comfortable making those changes on the House side, but for the record, the two that we have caught include on page 4, line 21. We would like to delete that line so that we're talking about values and beliefs with respect to healthcare, that people may choose to make decisions that aren't necessary to preserve life, and we want to respect that. So we want to speak just generally to healthcare because that may include chronic care decisions. And on page 16, lines 6 and 7, one of the new features of this legislation is that healthcare representatives must accept those appointments as the healthcare representative. So somebody isn't getting a phone call in the middle of the night that they are the healthcare representative and this is the first they've heard about it, and they have no idea what Aunt Sally wants. So in this case, what we've done is say that the healthcare representative, in order to be an acceptable healthcare representative, needs to accept that appointment. Here, it would suggest that that acceptance needs to be witnessed or notarized, and that was not the intent of the work group. So this is just a cleanup measure that puts the bill in line with the expectations. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Dirksen, and we're happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Dirksen, clinical ethicist at the Providence Center for Healthcare Ethics. Thank you for the opportunity to share our support for Senate Bill 1552. Providence Health and Services mission calls us to nurture the well-being and honor the uniqueness of every person, particularly the poor and vulnerable, and those values are at the core of everything we do, including our engagement with the Advanced Directive Work Group. Providence has been engaged in discussions around the revision to Oregon's advance directives during the 2015 session and throughout the interim. Our core principles and desired outcomes include: be patient and family-centric, The primary purpose for updating the advance directive is to make the process more accessible to Oregonians, regardless of socioeconomic class, religion, or primary language. We sincerely hope the work group is able to accomplish this end with the framework this legislation allows. The forum should be focused on patients first and all others, healthcare providers, attorneys, and other interested parties second. Respect the diversity of other people's needs. While we recognize the opinion of the legal and broader healthcare communities that a single form is necessary to simplify the process, Providence strongly believes that allowing recognition of multiple forms in Oregon is the best way to respect the varied religious and cultural needs of all people. Promote decision-making consistent with evidence-based clinical best practices. When patients engage in advanced care planning, this assumes the intervention desired is within the range of medically appropriate care. Ensuring language to this end guards against patients or clinicians misunderstanding the applicability of the directions they provide. Senate Bill 1552 does improve the advance directive's process and forms for Oregonians. While this bill doesn't do everything we would have hoped, it is a major step forward in creating a form that will be patient-centered. Providence respectfully requests the committee take quick action on this bill and move it forward. Thank you for the opportunity to provide comment.
Chair Pozanski and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt with Cambia Health Solutions. Just delighted to be here in support of Senate Bill 1552. There's a couple of people who deserve particular thanks. Chana did an enormous amount of work through the interim. I don't know how many meetings we had, but Chana was at every one, and we made her take copious notes so that we didn't have to. And Mark Mayer, Legislative Council, has been very patient with us as we've worked through some very delicate language things, and the Bar Association played host to these very large work group meetings. My colleagues have done a good job of describing the why. I'd like to take just a minute and at a high level at least describe what the Dash Ones now do. We've broken down what used to, the old or the current law is. We have one giant form in statute where one appoints, you know, who can speak for me and go through kind of a checklist. Through a lot of discussion, we came to agreement that the part of appointing who is going to speak for me ought to be very consistent every time it happens. And so the bill will update that and have it be a form in statute. Critically, it simplifies how we get that authorized. In the current law, there's a long list of people who cannot be a witness. So if you find yourself in the hospital and needing to fill one of these out, today under the law, there's pretty much nobody in the building who's allowed to say that you are who you say you are and be a witness. So we simplified that and said you can either have a witness or a notary, which many facilities have on staff, and we took out almost all of the list of who cannot be a witness and just left it at those who would have a potential obvious conflict, the primary care provider or the person who's being designated as the appointed representative. And we provide for alternate representatives. We clarify some of the other administration around that. For the other piece, the very important instructions, how do I convey my wishes about what kind of health care I would want when I can't speak for myself? We thought it best to appoint a permanent rules task force that will live in the health division, in the public health area of the health division. And that is composed of attorneys with expertise in health care, representatives of various aspects of health care, and very importantly, consumer representatives, and then a member of the House and a member of the Senate. So we have a very broad group, but all who have some background and expertise in this very sensitive space. And their task will be to develop what will become the uniform form that's used to convey one's wishes, but those two things will go together to be the valid advanced care directive and will be then posted by the Public Health Division. We had a lot of discussion about where should this live, and we landed there because public health is really good at health promotion and those kinds of things, and it may not be the absolute perfect fit, but it was probably the best fit that we could all think of as an agency to help guide this. The Rules Advisory Committee will have to report back here every 2 years. They have requirements about how often they have to meet, and they have to give this a thoroughgoing over, and there's direction to continuously update it, but not less than every 4 years, so we don't go another 20 or 25 years without touching this thing. So we think this is going to be a lot more consumer-friendly, make it much easier for people to convey their wishes. One of the things that people will be able to do is attach something beyond what is actually in the form. So that allows both for some existing things that are out there. I think when we heard this before, we talked about five wishes being something that's used in a lot of places. That's something people could attach. But we are also thinking about how technology is advancing, and one can foresee that it might become possible in the foreseeable future to do something that can actually be put into a medical record using technology. As Jessica mentioned, we're all pouring through this Gutten Stuff Amendment, and we found a couple small things. I know the Nurses Association has a terminology need that we've agreed to fix in what will be a temporary form that is the most improvement we could make, we thought, for now until the Rules Advisory Committee gets its work done. But any of those things, I think we're all very, very comfortable in taking care of those on the Senate side. This is directionally, on the House side, directionally, this is all very good. We have, having read through it a couple of times since yesterday evening, nothing really major or a conceptual problem that any of us see. So this is very close to being ready to go, and we'd recommend moving it out of this committee and on its way over to the House, and we'll take care of the last Scrivener's bits over there when it gets there.
I'd be happy
to take any questions.
Mr. Chair, if I may add one more kind of component to the bill, really important to us was to make sure, and this was done through the savings clause process at the end of the bill, any form that has been properly executed to date or through at any point, including forms where somebody's printed them from 1997 and they pull one out after from the box after the form has technically expired, all of those will be honored. So Oregonians need not worry that a form that they filled out 20 years ago won't be honored. If you come in from another state, your form that you executed properly there will also be honored. So if you lived in Idaho your entire life and you moved here to go into long-term care with your kids, and you had a valid advance directive there, we will honor it here. And so that was really important to us, to make sure that Oregonians weren't in a position where they had to re-up. Yeah, that was not a productive outcome, so we made sure that wasn't the case. I also was deficient in recognizing the state bar. This is a hard conversation, and there are lots of interests, and we really appreciate them coming to the table too and working this through. Their input into the ongoing rules advisory process is going to be essential to make sure that we really get that component right too.
Senator Cruz,
just a comment. I think public health is an absolutely appropriate place for this. They are the keeper of records. So I can't think of a better place for this to reside.
Senator Gilster.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the advisory committee is a great idea. I guess what I don't understand is why the rush to have a new form before the committee does its work. It seems that if we're going to create this advisory group, we should have them do that work rather than rush ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Gelser, one of the things that is improved in the temporary form that mirrors what will be permanent in statute are the appointment of the healthcare representatives and the witnessing requirements. Current statute is very restrictive on witnessing, as Tom discussed. by updating that component, it makes it a lot easier. In addition, the acceptance component that we felt was important, that is now worked into this new form. So those are the, I would say, the primary changes that are identified and made possible in the new form or in the temporary form. We believe those are positive changes. There isn't a change to the current instructions portion of the form in a substantial way, and so that remains the same. Again, that where the work group will spend, or the Rules Advisory Committee will spend most of their time improving that, but the permanent healthcare appointment form, which is the first form that you see in this draft, will now mirror the temporary form, and that we believe is an improvement that ought to happen sooner than the working it out with the work group.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, in preparing for today, I was going through correspondence that we had received, and I'd seen some concerns had been raised about that change by the disability community, and I hope that we would have the opportunity to hear from them and better understand those concerns before taking action to
well the to go. Plan okay we'll come back to that other comments or first Senator Thatcher.
Well, a little bit along that line too, I'm not real clear on how this committee functions, whether they are going to be just voting to adopt rules and then going ahead and changing them, or if they come back to us first, or if they're just reporting back to us to tell us what they did, you know, after the fact. I'm not real clear on that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Thatcher, this committee will be given, as many bills give, a Rules Advisory Committee the authority to go out and develop rules around certain sections of statute. They will be empowered in the same way. They will be required to come back and report to you on what they did and why, and any suggested changes over the long term about the statutory components, but that will not require approval of the Legislative Assembly in order for the new form to become effective.
Okay. So, yes, Senator Rosemary.
So just two clarifications. I know you said that if you have an existing advance directive, you won't, it will still have full force of law or whatever. If somebody comes into a hospital in an emergency situation, though, and they're competus mentis, are they going to be asked to complete a new form at that point? No.
No.
And Mr. Kevin. Chair, Senator Rosenbaum, one of the critical pieces in all of this is that only a person who is at that time, you know, competent to be able to fill out the form can do that and have it be valid. Someone who's not in a position to really speak for themselves is not, you know, the kind of situation you describe, I would think not, but Kevin may want to.
Yeah. Mr. Chair.
Let me just clarify my question. I'm saying if somebody is competent, but they are in an emergency situation, I guess I don't understand at what point a new form would replace the old form if the old form is going to stay in effect anyway.
It won't. I mean, my understanding is this is really what we're trying to do is transition everyone. We're also honoring, we don't want to have people get caught because they have executed properly an old form, right, and not be able to have that.
Okay, so really it's just
still valid.
If you don't have an advance directive at all,
right?
Yes,
right.
That's
the
correct.
Point this is approved,
right.
You'll start
right.
using. We'll start using
right.
this new form.
Right, and I think to follow up and segue with Senator Yeltsin, I think the importance of having this, I'm going to call it transitional form, is
yes.
to allow for broader use and take away some of the hindrances that we have currently. Because if we continue to use that old form, we're going to disadvantage some people from actually getting one. So this is something that the work group has put together. It made a lot of sense to me from mm-hmm. my update from Chana as to how the group was working. So we're going to just see this transitional part of where at some point in the distant future, all of these old forms will be gone because the individuals are no longer around. And then you will have that movement into this new form that's going to be uniform. And the part about for Senator Thatcher on the work group, I mean, this is pretty, or the RAC, pretty similar to what we see with agencies getting a new policy bill passed, and they have to make rules. And so I think the important part for me is that this work group came up with who should be part of it, in the sense of the representatives, to ensure we have a balanced perspective with the different values that are necessary, the attorneys on the legal side, the docs and the health providers on another side, as to trying to accommodate this. And I'm going to make some other comments, but that's what I took away from all the work.
And Mr. Chair, there is a requirement to report back, so we do have checks and balance in this as well. So,
Mr. Chair, if I may, you've described very well how we got to this point. I would just note that at our very large table, we very consistently had attorneys from the various sections of the bar that deal in this space, different aspects of health care, from long-term care to hospitals to frontline physicians, and we had consumer groups at AARP, I know Disability Rights Oregon was at least some of the meetings, but we did make a real effort to have that continuity over the last several months to make sure all those perspectives were at the table and not just heard, but their concerns and ideas incorporated into what's now the near final bill.
All right. Let me ask a question, because I know the work group has put a lot of time in. I understand that there was some discussion in the work group that potentially the work group might want to continue to meet during this, let's say, continued interim. Is this something I just want to put on the record, whether we should have that continue as we go through this process?
Yes, Mr. Chair. As we got to the end, Mr. Mayor pointed out that there's a number of cross references having to do with, you know, power of attorney terminology that are going to need further fixing. They're not precisely about our issue here, we thought it would be useful for us to then kind of take on identifying those things in the continuing interim and come back to you with suggestions of on fixing that, but it's not essential for the bill, you know, for the advanced directive piece at this time.
And Mr. Chair, we would characterize that perhaps more as technical cleanup as opposed to significant substantive changes. While there may be a thing or two that we identify along the way, the intent would not to be to bring a major policy piece as we've brought here today, but more how do we standardize language so that it's clear in statute what we mean and when.
Okay. So potentially we'll see something in 17 which will take care of these other issues as it comes forward. So we're going to have another opportunity even as this as being rolled out. So let me ask if there's any other questions or comments for this panel. If not, then I want to make a couple of comments. First of all, I want to thank Chana, because I got to hear a lot of the discussions that were happening by Chana. I really thank you for taking the lead, and then for the work group itself. There is no doubt that this was one of those situations going into it. Everyone knew we needed to do something, but everyone had their perspective of how to do it. And it really takes that opportunity to get everyone around the table multiple times to actually hear each other. And I think everyone in that work group, from what I heard, played fair, heard everyone, and then y'all came up with this product. And I understand that with the Dash ones that we now have, they're still needing to look at that. And Senator Gelser, before you got here, the discussion was that the Dash ones are still being looked at. There's a couple of amendments that are going to need to be made,
okay,
that are going to be made on the House side. I'm concerned as the chair that we need to go ahead and move the bill forward. It will be coming back to us to actually have a second look,
okay,
this session, because they're going to do a Dash 2 over here. It has to come back for us to concur.
Thanks, and I appreciate that. I'm sorry if we're not asking that before. Mm-hmm. I got that in my email late last night.
No, I appreciate that. And then also I want to thank Senator Cruz. For those who don't follow the rules, the way a committee has the ability to introduce three bills, the chair has the option on two, and then the third one requires the vice chair to agree. And Senator Cruz was very happy to be signing on this bill as allowing it to go forward. So I think this has been a really good exercise and shows how if everyone gets together and just talk, maybe we can actually get something done. So,
Mr. Chair, this is a very important piece of work that we have here. It truly is, and we've been talking about this for a long time, and it's nice that we're finally actually accomplishing something. So I want to thank the work group too. This is a good product. It's not perfect, but then nothing ever is.
It's a living document. We'll be able to revisit multiple times if necessary. So thank you all very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
I got Jack Dempsey on here. And let me ask while Jack's coming up, is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 1552? Jack?
Thank you, Chair Przanski. Members, Jack Dempsey representing the Oregon Nurses Association. That one up.
Freudian slip.
Yeah. I just wanted to express our support for this measure, appreciate the work of the committee and your committee staff with the help on this. There is just one change I wanted to put on the record that we're suggesting to the temporary form. The language in that is very physician-specific. Today in Oregon, nurse practitioners do all the services that are listed on there, such as ordering feeding tubes inserted or removed. So we are suggesting some language to make that a little more inclusive of other providers that do these services. We're also happy to get the bill moving and make these changes over in the House.
All right, thank you. Any questions for Jack? Thank you very much. So we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing, and I'm going to stand down for a moment. I think I'm going to just take a... After a 35-second recess, we're back up, and I've been corrected. We do not have the paperwork, and because we do not have the paperwork, we cannot move the bill today. What we will be doing is carrying over Senate Bill 1552 till tomorrow. Hopefully, the paperwork will be here, and we can go ahead and do the work session on it then. So with that, now we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1552. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1567. Whitney?
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. This is Senate Bill 1567, and it is brought to us by Senator Thatcher. There is no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact. This measure creates the crime of criminal impersonation. Impersonation is when a person intentionally poses as an individual without permission and with the intent to injure the individual by communicating to a third party with the intent to deceive the third party that the person is the individual. This impersonation is currently not prohibited in the Criminal Code of Oregon. For instance, identity theft requires the intent to deceive or defraud. By case law, the Supreme Court recently in 2015 defined deception deceive for the identity theft statute as including a requirement to attempt to obtain an unwarranted advantage. The Court of Appeals also defined defraud to include an intent to injure another's legal rights or interests. Senate Bill 1567 makes this impersonation a Class A misdemeanor and also creates a statutory private cause of action for victims harmed by the impersonation, and there are no amendments.
All right, thank you. Senator Thatcher, did you want to make any comments before we bring witnesses up?
Maybe just to put it in some layman term here. I think this kind of builds – I like the legalese. No insult. Not meant. I think this kind of builds on what the work we did last session with the revenge porn and the upskirting bill, in that it deals with the sexual element, humiliation, and all that. So, but it also builds on ID theft, in that, you know, people can impersonate you and steal from your accounts and, you know, cause financial harm. But this would directly relate to adopting somebody else's, impersonating somebody else and then causing them harm. There was this one case where a guy broke up with his girlfriend and then chose to impersonate her on Craigslist and other social media and created profiles in her name, pretending to be her, solicited anonymous violent sexual encounters, and continued to, pose as her, was corresponding with several men who responded to these solicitations, or whatever you want to call it, and at this point, And then arranged for a man to go to her home and sexually assault her. And he was only convicted as an accomplice, even though he arranged this whole thing. And this would help give prosecutors a tool to convict individuals criminally impersonating before a violent act happens. So I guess this is sick world out there, I tell you.
Well, crazy.
I do question the sponsor list. It's a very shady sponsor list.
So we have three individuals that are signed up at this point to give testimony on Senate Bill 1567. Aaron Knott, Brenda Tracy, and Jackie Swanson. Why don't the three of you come forward, please?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Attorney General in the Department of Justice, and both counsel and Senator Thatcher got that exactly right. So the origin of this concept, Senate Bill 1567, came about from the work we did last year on Senate Bill 188, which was the revenge porn bill. And in the pendency of that bill, if you remember, we had to make another bill right away because somebody came forward and said, this horrible thing happened to me. Does it fit your bill? And I had to say no, and we were able to come up with a fix for that individual. Around the same time, I was contacted by two other women, one in Portland, one in Pendleton, calling my attention to something brand new. And this is the fact pattern that was described. Basically, in both cases, they were either married or dating. And upon separating, the man got on the internet and pretended to be the woman. And I could say this was on dating websites, but they had names like fling.com, and they were set up mostly to solicit anonymous sexual encounters. And one of these women found this only because she started receiving on her cell phone a high number of unsolicited photos of male genitalia. And she texted one of them back and essentially said, you know, why are you sending this to me? And the gentleman surprisingly was very polite and said, well, because I read on the internet that I am to come to your house at 9 p.m. tonight and a whole bunch of us will have sex with you. And so this woman lived there alone with her daughter, who I believe was 3 or 4 at the time, had to flee her home and lived out of a hotel room, terrified to go back for a month. Work was disrupted. Every aspect of home life was disrupted. Took down every shred of identity she had on the internet, every social media site, Googled herself, and everything she found, she deleted. And that's where that one stopped. But Jebediah Stipe, the case in California that Senator Thatcher mentioned, the woman didn't know that anyone was coming. And in that case, the ex had taken the additional step of zeroing in on one person and basically saying, you know, kick the door in if you have to. And no matter what I tell you, it's all part of the game. Don't stop. And they were able to convict this person only because there was a rape. And so he was, as Senator Satcher said, exactly right, an accomplice to that. But in California, as in Oregon right now, if that conduct isn't consummated, it's not a crime. And the reason for that is because our identity theft statute, as mentioned by counsel, contains the words deceive or defraud. And that's been interpreted by the Court of Appeals basically to mean you have to have some sort of a monetary or other vested legal right being taken from you. Identity theft is in the property crime section of the code for that reason. It's all about taking something of value away from you. Its root is in theft. It's not in harassment. So what that ends up meaning is that if you assume the identity of another person with the intent to humiliate them, harass them, even expose them to physical harm, it's not covered under 165800. So this is meant to fill that gap. This creates the new crime of criminal impersonation, which takes place when you hold yourself out to be another person for the sake of humiliation or harassment. This language was developed in consultation with the district attorneys, the defense attorneys, the ACLU, and the Electronic Frontier Foundation. The reason you had so many players in that room, all of whom agreed that the change, that it wasn't covered by existing law, is because the constitutional interests here are very specific. It's very hard to regulate speech, but we're fairly confident, mostly because of the work we did on revenge porn, that this is a constitutional version. So this bill does a number of things. First of all, it prohibits impersonating another individual with the intent to intimidate, threaten, harass, or physically harm under the circumstances I mentioned earlier. Secondly, it provides that person with a private right of action so that they can sue in civil court for the damages caused by that conduct. Third, it makes a series of LC amendments to what was the existing crime of criminal impersonation. That crime already existed under that name, but after consultation with LC, they decided to change that crime to criminal impersonation of a public servant. That already existing crime occurs when basically you hold yourself out to be a peace officer, a judge, a justice of the peace, or another public servant. They also made a technical move there where they move statutory language from one section to another. It was non-substantive, and it was done purely at the behest of legislative counsel. This bill also has the support of the Sexual Assault Task Force, the chiefs, the sheriffs. No known opposition to this bill, and I think all of the major judiciary types have seen and approved it. So I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. Before we take questions, let's go ahead and have the rest of the panel give their testimony.
Okay. Chair Pazanski and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jacqueline Swanson. I'm an attorney in Portland. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony in support of this bill, and in particular, thank you to Senator Thatcher, who was the chief sponsor. The internet, as we all know, provides an easy and accessible free flow of information and is a valuable tool for self-expression and education. However, unfortunately, it's also become a tool by which abusers and offenders may use it to harm victims of stalking, domestic violence, bullying, and sexual assault in particular. The two main types of misrepresentation have already been identified here. The first involves the creation of a fictitious profile in order to impersonate the victim, such as happened in on the Craigslist example. The second involves an abuser obtaining access to a victim's social media profile or other type of profile, either indirectly or through hacking into their account or by gaining their password and making posts on their behalf. There are only a small number of states have passed legislation specifically addressing this issue with respect to electronic communications, which is it's extremely important, as mentioned by Mr. Knott as well as counsel, considering the fact that most identity theft statutes don't cover this type of crime because of the pecuniary interests involved. I believe that this bill signals that Oregon will be at the forefront of protecting victims' interests as well as their emotional and psychological well-being, and therefore I offer my testimony in support. Thank you.
Yeah. Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. My name is Brenda Tracy. I'm just here to add a survivor voice, not specifically in the arena that I've had someone hack my account and impersonate me yet. And I say yet, because as I have spoken out and become kind of a public voice on this issue, I recognize the threat of the internet. I recognize the impactfulness of the internet and the ability for people to hide behind internet, social media accounts, and that kind of thing to threaten, harass, intimidate, and kind of, you know, put forth their agenda without really saying who they are. In the short time I've been a public voice on sexual assault and violence issues, I've received threats of my own, usually anonymous profiles, that type of thing. But it's unnerving. I can't imagine what these other people have gone through. I mean, just for me, you wonder if you know that person that threatened to. I specifically remember a threat where a man, I'm assuming it was a man, had said I wasn't raped correctly the first time, and he would show me what a real rape was. But you wonder if you know that person. You wonder if you pass by that person. You wonder who that is. This is a very specific type of harassment and threat, and I think we should take it very seriously. Our laws have to catch up with technology. And as predators and abusers become more stealth and more creative, they figure out ways to exploit their victims. And I'm mainly just here as a voice for victims to say that we really do need to pass this law. We need to make sure that we have good laws in Oregon that protect victims of this type of abuse. The consequences and the repercussions of this type of abuse are long-lasting. And if there's anything we can do to prevent this type of trauma on our citizens of the state, then we absolutely should. And so I thank you for allowing me to be here today, and I ask that you would pass this through.
All right, thank you. So any questions or comments?
I just want to say thank you, especially to Aaron Knott and the Attorney General's office for their hard work in bringing the parties together and making sure that this is constitutional and all, you know, and for everybody else who's supporting this, and I appreciate you coming up and testifying.
So I have one question, and Aaron, this is really for you, and I just want to put on the record whether or not I just wanted to look again at the solicitation statute. My reading, quick reading of it, it appears that a person who actually is engaged in the same conduct could be charged with solicitation because they are soliciting someone to actually commit an act. Do you think, off the top, if the person being solicited has to know that they're being solicited to commit the act, or would you think that the person who's engaged in doing the solicitation would still be potentially held to that standard of under solicitation? And if you want to get back to me without, I know you haven't read it.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, I guess the first question I'd have on solicitation, it's of course completely legal to get on the internet and say, I am interested in a sexual encounter that is consensual, that is not for money, that's, you know, that's Craigslist, and there are websites like that all over the place that's protected under the Constitution. It's normalized behavior. So there's not a consideration aspect in this. There's no money being exchanged. So you're not trying to solicit sex for any sort of compensation. That would make me concerned about that statute. Beyond that, I would have to look into it and get back to you.
I think on the record, I'd just like to say, from my quick review, it says a person commits the crime of solicitation if with the intent of causing another to engage in specific conduct constituting, then they talk about what type of crimes, the person commands or solicits such other person to engage in that conduct. So I'm putting this on the record because I think that there may be more than one charge that could be applicable here, and it's something that I hope that whoever is reviewing these type of cases are looking for those, because if we can actually come at it at multiple directions, I think it would be appropriate for that to be done, because it does have substantial penalties that are attached to a solicitation charge. So that's just my comment.
Mr. Chair, could I indulge you for one more comment? There's something I should have mentioned earlier and didn't. I've noted that this has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, but my understanding is it's also been given a minimal fiscal impact, which is consistent with the revenge porn statute. I just wanted to call your attention to the fact that right now that exists, and I don't know if this is projected to have a fiscal impact.
We've, I guess, been given the clearance to have that removed, but I do have a question that I need to follow up with the leadership before we actually move the bill. So this is just kind of in general for the operation of the committee. So what we're going to do is take the rest of the testimony today, and then we will continue this one over for tomorrow, and hopefully we'll have the answers I need to have before going forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So any other questions for anyone on this panel? Again, thank you all very much for coming forward. Now, I understand there may be others in the room that wanted or were considering wanting to give testimony on Senate Bill 1567. Not that we're asking you to step forward, but if you feel comfortable wanting to come forward, we'd love to have you come forward. So I'm going to give anyone in the room an opportunity to signal if they want to come forward. If not, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing. All right, with that, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1567. And as I just put on the record, the goal at this point is to have this bill on its way tomorrow. We will be meeting tomorrow, and we have one other bill that hopefully we'll be able to do the work session on with the paperwork coming in. And then I'll get the clarity I need to have before advancing this particular bill. So with that, I think I just closed the public hearing on 1567. I don't believe there's anything else that we need to do. Christy, anything? Charlene? All right, so tomorrow, folks, 8 o'clock.
Yep.
So until 8 o'clock, we're adjourned. 8 o'clock, we're adjourned.